Hi, this is Scott. I really appreciate our sponsors because they make the show possible. Today's show is sponsored by Telerik. Create compelling app experiences across any screen with the Telerik platform. Telerik's end-to-end platform uniquely combines industry-leading UI tools with cloud services to simplify the entire app development cycle. Telerik offers everything .NET developers need to build quality apps faster. Try it free at telerik.com/platform. That's telerik.com/platform. I want to take a second to tell you about my sponsor, Raygun. If you want to detect and diagnose errors and crashes in your software, and even find problems that you didn't know existed to improve your software, then Raygun is likely perfect for you. You just add a few lines of code to your application, and in minutes you get real-time error reports with all the information that you need to fix bugs fast. You can even hook it up to your team chat, your bug tracking, and any other development workflow tools. Raygun covers all major web and mobile programming languages, including .NET, the full Xamarin stack, JavaScript, and many more. Go check out Raygun today at raygun.io. I even use it myself on my little startup, and I really, truly recommend this product. It's a fantastic product. Check it out, Raygun at raygun.io.
From HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 489. In this episode, Scott talks with NodeSource's VP of Engineering, Kevin Stewart, about enterprising Node.js.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and I'm here today talking with Kevin Stewart, who is a VP of Engineering at NodeSource. How are you, sir?
I'm pretty good, Scott. Thanks for having me.
No, thanks for chatting with me today. So one of the things that I wanted to talk about with you is that you've got an interesting background, not just in open source, working on things like NodeSource, but then you started in kind of classic commercial software at Adobe.
Yes, that's correct. I've spent about 10 years at Adobe prior to NodeSource, where I worked on a variety of things on Adobe's Creative Suite, things from the installers to metadata services as we started to transition towards the cloud. And then I was lucky enough to work on one of the initial services of Creative Cloud, which was, became Creative Cloud Assets. We focused on basically providing a place for all of our customers' assets to be stored and collaborated on. And that evolved into things like Creative Cloud Libraries. And around that time was when I was approached by NodeSource to help them grow their business, and I decided to make the move.
Mm-hmm. And when you were working at Adobe, were they already thinking about open source and bringing open source into the forefront?
Absolutely. There was the acquisition of companies like PhoneGap, which was one of the big catalysts of starting to look at how Adobe could contribute to open source and participate in it. With the Apache Cordova project, we started looking at our own IP and seeing, are there things that the open source community would benefit by having Adobe donate and participate in a more open manner? And internally, our CTO started driving more for a model of open source style development, even on the commercial products.
Mm-hmm. So then it was natural to get into open source.
Totally.
Yeah.
We were big consumers of open source for probably the last 8 years at Adobe. I pushed our team to say, let's use open source as much as possible, where I could work with legal to make it happen, contribute things back. So it just became second nature after a while.
Mm-hmm. And what does NodeSource do? Because it's really about, it seems to me like from looking at the website, it's about the enterprising of Node.
Yes, we're trying to position ourselves as the enterprise node company, mm-hmm. and working to find a balance between contributing to the community while serving the needs of enterprise customers. And there isn't as much overlap with Node historically and enterprise problems, but the enterprise has adopted Node and there are certain types of problems, applications, technologies that need to be addressed to support their needs. And that's what NodeSource is looking to address.
So like most open source projects aren't like ready for the enterprise out of the box, right?
No.
Enterprise has unique kind of issues.
Very unique, or at least Different than, say, your typical open source hacker or, you know, the 5-person team at a startup trying to build a consumer internet application, there are different concerns that enterprises have. And in typical open source fashion, you tend to scratch your own itch. And some of those enterprise needs aren't itches that one guy in his room coding is looking to solve.
What is it about the enterprise that's so like unique, or why does the enterprise think that it's unique? Like when you say like, you know, one guy or one gal in their garage, they don't have an enterprise problem because they don't have what? Smart cards? They don't have certificate storage?
They don't have a lot of compliance issues that they need to deal with, legal issues, international issues. So there's so many things that are really the area that enterprises have to deal with, things that are just common things. Like I've had to deal with localization so many times,
and right, dealing with multiple countries,
multiple currencies and multiple countries, yeah. Localization versus globalization, because there is a difference. Exporting SSL, like the number of times that, you know, some lawyers said, all right, make sure we're not exporting cryptography, and then having to explain that, well, you're not really exporting cryptography when you're using SSL, and things like that are not the sort of things that most open source developers typically have to deal with. There's also a perception issue. I mean, I think Joel Spolsky had a post years ago about the 5 different worlds of software development, and sort of made a distinction between commercial software developers and sort of corporate in-house, you know, line of business developers. And there's been this unusual and unfortunate, I believe, divide between the hipster developer, you know, working in San Francisco, building the next great photo sharing app, and then, you know, the lemming that's in, you know, the 3-piece suit, which nobody wears anymore, building yet another database reporting application. Mm-hmm. And yet, in reality, they all have similar problems. I mean, we're in a cloud era. We're hosting things on public clouds, or we're dealing with scaling issues. So there's a lot more similarities between those different worlds of developers, but there's sort of a cultural gap between the two. And that's one of the things that we're hoping to sort of bridge the gap a little bit, especially in the Node world.
Right, right. And technology these days are kind of standing on the shoulders of giants and making things that were once difficult much easier. And a lot of people look at the enterprise as like, oh, here's a bunch of hoops I have to jump through. But at the same time, they are well understood hoops.
Yes. There is a certain comfort in knowing that these problems have been solved, so we don't need to go solve them again. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the key differentiators between enterprise development, is that there's more focus on solving the business problem and not yet again building another app server or another ORM. You know, we have more pressing needs, usually around revenue, making money. So let's solve those problems that assist the business, as opposed to just trying to do the same thing in a different way with using another language or another framework.
So as an example, I'm not trying to sound like a commercial, but just as an example, what is a tool that NodeSource does that Node didn't do? Like, what is a need that was required to put Node into the enterprise that you filled?
So a product, in one sense, is just support and training. Many customers look at a particular technology and they immediately want, you know, who's the one throat to choke, or who do I go to when I'm having a problem with that? So while we don't look at support traditionally as a product, by packaging up in a certain way, you know, here's a tier of support for just experimenting with Node and, you know, trying it on your development servers, understanding how the technology works. Mm-hmm. That's one level of offering. Then as you're sort of graduating up to a proof of concept, a small application, you'll probably want a little bit more support than that, especially if you're trying to make a case to your leadership team. And then finally, when you're really running an application in production and you have a development team, but you want some extra hands to help out, help you scale, help you solve a particular problem, that's another offering. So we just released N-Support, which is our commercial Node support offering. Second product that we have is called N-Chip, which is really taking the idea of a deterministic build of an artifact, which would be your Node application. So in the Java world, you have something like a jar file or a WAR file, which is your application, and you can deploy that as a single unit.
Well, it's all statically built, so then there's always the sense of the reliable, repeatable build.
Exactly. We don't really have that in the Node world, but there's a lot of scenarios where that would be very valuable. So we built Nship to take your Node application, do some sort of static analysis on it, like go through all the Node modules, see if there's any license issues, and there's no license for some module.
You mean like we as an enterprise have decided we're going to use MIT and then some GPL snuck in there?
Exactly. That's the biggest use case of, you know, has any GPL snuck into the code? Or if we say we're all Apache, you can set up those sort of rules. We check with the Node security project to see if there are any modules in your project that have a known security vulnerability. Flag that and say, hey, there's a newer version. And we also built an API so that you can add your own plugins to that system to build whatever compliance rules that you need before you have a final bundle that you can then deploy to your environments. And the third product is actually one that's coming out.
We're sort of in ship mode.
So I can't go into too much details about it other than the Node runtime itself can be a bit of a black box. So you're running a large Node application in production, and all of a sudden you're seeing memory leaks and can't really determine where. And I've had this problem previously at Adobe running a Node application where our service was just getting hammered for some reason, and we couldn't find out exactly what was going on with the Node portion of it because the runtime is just opaque. So we're working on a way to sort of crack that open a little bit and get more runtime visibility into what's going on to your Node application, and then integrate that with other people's solutions so you can add it to your dashboards and your monitoring solutions.
Okay, so if I use New Relic or something like that, I can plug it in and get much more insight into what's going
on.
But when you're out selling enterprise software, and the software that you're selling also happens to be built on open source, aren't you almost selling open source as a concept as much as you are selling your product?
Oh, yeah. And we embrace that. A lot of companies have sort of turned the corner and understand that open source is becoming the de facto way to build software, or at least a normal way. There's not as much fear as there used to be. And I think that the growth of cloud in one sense has helped that. The bulk of open source software that's really valuable to companies has tended to be on the infrastructure level. So people have gotten accustomed to, you know, having open source web servers, open source databases, open source development tools, and that's made it easier to make some of those sales. The real complication has sort of been dealing with these customers that have these legacy code bases, and how do they migrate them to a new world? And that's where Node has actually played a huge part in making that transformation, because you can't just rewrite your entire, you know, financial application that's been in Java since Java first came out. And you have challenges like, how do I tackle mobile? I have all these employees that are not using desktops anymore. They're on their mobile phones, and our applications weren't designed with mobile in mind. So that's one use case where Node has played a part with mobile web development, building these front ends that talk to these legacy systems and support their mobile web applications, building APIs so that you can have native apps talking to your backend systems.
Maybe you can expand a little bit more on the mobile thing, because I don't quite understand that. Like, if I'm using something really old, like let's say I'm even using, God forbid, classic ASP.
Yeah.
I could still produce Bootstrap HTML, or I could produce responsive design and some decent CSS. Where does Node have a strength when it comes to things like thinking about mobile?
Node has a strength in terms of people, say if you don't have developers with those competencies anymore. So you might have an old system that was done in ColdFusion, but now you no longer have any ColdFusion developers, and nobody wants to touch that system that's critical to your business. So using Node as sort of a proxy layer to build the new functionality you need on top, talking to that older system that's still running, and then generating your mobile interface, that is a common pattern that we're seeing.
I see. So people are swapping out the brains, and they're doing transplants.
Yes.
Putting a little Node here and a little Node
there. Sprinkling it through and using it to support these newer use cases.
This episode of Hansel Minutes is brought to you by Braintree, code for easy online payments. If you're building a mobile app and you're searching for a simple payment solution, check out Braintree. The Braintree V.0 SDK makes it easy to offer multiple mobile payment types. So you can start accepting PayPal, Apple Pay, Bitcoin, Venmo, credit cards, and more, all with a single integration. One small snippet of code and you're set up in less than 10 minutes. If you don't have time, you can give them a call. They'll even handle the integration for you and walk you through it. The SDK supports 7 languages: .NET, Node, Java, Perl, PHP, Python, and Ruby, elegant code, clear documentation. To learn more and for your first $50,000 in transactions fee-free, go to braintreepayments.com/Hanselman. That's braintreepayments.com/Hanselman. One of the things that I found frustrating about Node, and I wonder if it has become a problem in the enterprise space, is that it feels just like even a hello world or a non-trivially sized application involves, you know, 70 or 80 or 100 NPM modules. So, you know, hello world's like 80 megs and 3,000 files because of the way NPM works.
Right.
And the versions and the closures of versions on, like, you know, this thing A wants the version something of C, and then thing B wants a different version of C.
Yep.
That's really overwhelming. I mean, there's no, like, again, coming from a .NET person's perspective, there's no base class library.
That's correct. It's sort of a double-edged sword, right? So one of the benefits of Node is the fact that we have the NPM repository and all these modules that cover so many different things that you can tap into. The problem, of course, is discoverability. How do you know which is the best OAuth module or which is the best web framework? A lot of them look alike, and there are no real sources. When you start Googling around, you might find outdated references to things like, mm-hmm. This was great 3 years ago, but it's not great now. So there is that problem. That is definitely a pain point, and it is something that we've been thinking about. How do we address at NodeSource? Because, again, we do architectural evaluations with customers, and they need guidance on these things.
Like, right. People want prescriptions.
They absolutely want prescriptions. And that's, again, sort of another differentiator between the open source mindset and the enterprise mindset. Open source guys basically want, I want to do whatever I want to do. Let me, you know, figure out the best way to do things. Then we go to enterprise and, like, tell us what to do. Tell us what we should use. You know, we're not the experts. You are. You tell us what we should be doing.
I find that very confusing in the open source space, because it's like, if Moment.js or this certain time library is the bomb, then I standardize on it as an enterprise. And then a few months later, the 25-year-old that did that is decided it's finished. I think a lot of people have trouble in the open source space understanding the difference between dead and done.
Yes.
Like, it's okay for a project to be completed.
Absolutely. And you can even see that with things like text editors. Like, there was a time where people were, you know, greatly concerned, especially in the Mac world, when TextMate wasn't being updated. It was like, this is a great text editor, but it hasn't had an update. And the author was like, yeah, because it works. It works for me. Why do you feel that we have to constantly keep churning on things?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I do see enterprise customers getting a little bit frustrated with this, because at some point they want predictability. They want stability. They want things to sort of stay, you know, in one place long enough that they can actually build some confidence around it. Whereas on the open source side of things, they're like, constant change, churn. It's like, it's not good enough if it's standing still. And you probably saw a lot of that with the fork of Node that occurred last year between Node and IOJS. And neither side was right or wrong. It's just a different perspective. The original Node community was really into evolution, jumping on the latest technology. Then things sort of petered out around 0.10, where we got to a point where Node was kind of good enough. There were still some issues. And there was just a philosophical difference of, you know, Joyent being the corporate sponsor of Node and dealing with some of these enterprise needs, saying, hey, we need to slow this down a little bit and make things, you know, a little bit more solid before we do another release. And the original community saying, but, you know, we're getting behind on which version of V8 we're on. There are all these bugs. We want to add promises. We want to do this. And there was just some tension there. So, of course, a fork happened, as it does in the open source community. But there was still a desire to bring Node back together and try to find a common middle ground that we could all work on and say, let's get some of the benefits of moving faster and, you know, keeping up to date with certain technologies like V8, but think about how do we address these concerns that enterprises have with the pace that Node is moving, and how do they know they'll get support, and how do they know they'll just be comfortable knowing that their applications can keep running on this platform. So now that the Node reconciliation has occurred and we're going to merge those two code bases back together, one of the key components is a long-term support plan and figuring out how do we have LTS releases of Node that enterprise customers can say, I know this will be supported for the next 18 months, 2 years. I can standardize on this version of Node and not have the rug pulled out from under me. That's a key component of where we're going with Node. Okay. And we're definitely playing a key role in defining that LTS roadmap.
Yeah, I think that LTS, right, that long-term support is one of those great ideas that, you know, Ubuntu really jumped on. Yes. and ran with. And it's like, we're going to have TikTok releases every 6 months, and you're going to be able to stay with us and be on the cutting edge. But then, you know, every once in a while, every year or so, a year and a half, we'll give you one that we can all just count on. And you put that one into production.
Yes.
While the rest of us mess around on staging.
Yeah, it's a great model, and people have definitely warmed to it. So we're trying to sort of steal great ideas from the people who have pioneered that and do the same thing for Node.
Mm-hmm. One of the words that you said a couple of paragraphs ago that I want to come back and talk about was the notion of confidence. And I realized as you were saying that you know, enterprises want confidence and open source communities want confidence. And the things that they look for that inspire confidence are absolutely diametrically opposed. Yes. I visited a GitHub repo today for something that has actually been built into Windows 10, and I noticed that it said it hadn't been touched in 2 months. And in my mind, I mentally threw my hands up. And I go, more abandonware.
Yep.
This thing hasn't been touched in 2 months, and my inner open source clock was immediately offended. You know what I mean?
That is a normal reaction. Yes.
But at this 2 months, I mean, you know, you don't get a rec or a statement of work in 2 months in the enterprise.
If you're lucky.
Yeah. Exactly.
It is a cultural divide. Change is constant in open source, and we're accustomed to that. The difference is that a lot of people working in open source haven't worked in enterprises, so I've had the luxury of working in both environments, and I can totally understand where these enterprise customers are coming from when they're saying, this thing's changing every day. Oh my gosh. You know, what do I do? But I've also worked on the other side. I was like, hey, this project hasn't been touched in 2 months. This thing's probably got a billion bugs in it. You know, let me go look for something newer that's, you know, fresher.
And probably get yourself in trouble because it might be the one that's more baked that it's the one you should have picked.
Almost without fail, that's generally been the case.
Yeah. You know, I know that it would be an opinionated piece of software, but if there were a thing that NodeSource made that had a confidence index or some kind of a number that would express whether I, as an enterprise, you know, should put my confidence in this piece of software.
I'm going to smile and not say anything.
See, all good ideas have already been thought about. See, I have thought up an idea. And you've coded it in your mind, and you're off developing this idea.
All I will say, there may be a keynote document or a PDF in the NodeSource Dropbox that might hint at what you just talked about.
But you know, I think that when we talk about prescriptions, that's really what we need. You know, especially with these distributed base class libraries, right? Mm-hmm. That one of the things that made Java succeed and made .NET succeed early on was, here's a fully and completely designed by committee 250 megs of system dot this and that. And one of the things that makes Node difficult for people to jump into is the, all right, I want to parse a date. All right, well, you've got six options, you know, and one of them came out yesterday.
Paradox of choice. Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, it's, like I said, it's the double-edged sword, right? Node very much follows the Unix philosophy of small tools join together, do things well.
Good point.
And, you know, people have totally embraced that. But there comes a point where that actually gets in the way. And you even see this sort of playing out with the whole concept of microservices again, where people are loving this idea of breaking their services down into these really tiny components and coordinating them. And that's why Docker is now sort of the new thing that everybody's talking about. But as soon as you start doing that, then you run into the next level problem. I have all these little services. What's orchestrating them? What's coordinating them? What's managing them? Mm-hmm. So you get back into the almost monolithic approach where you take all these services, you don't have a good plan for orchestrating them, it becomes a monolith again. And, you know, it's really a matter of understanding your problem and coming up with the right solution to do it. And same thing with Node is there are all these modules out there. Sometimes it makes sense to use them. Sometimes it makes sense to write your own thing. I've run into cases where people are just grabbing modules off NPM, building a solution together, and just gluing it together is more of an effort than if you just wrote the code yourself to do the one thing you needed to do.
You're saying like literally the Googling for the library probably took more time than just writing the...
Exactly. One specific case we had when we were at Adobe running a Node service was we needed a particular piece of functionality, and it turned out that there was an existing module, but all it did was basically run a regex. And I'm like, so we just took on a dependency that has a regex that's now breaking in production because it doesn't have this one pattern that we need inside of it. And what are you going to send a pull request to get that module updated? I'm like, why don't you just steal the regex and put what we need in and have our own code? And I see a lot of this copy paste programming with NPM that's going on. And yes, that's good for getting up and running pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. But if you don't understand the implications of taking on all these dependencies and how it's going to affect you downstream, it's going to bite you. So that's part of our approach is not just building products, not just trying to sell things to enterprises, but giving them that understanding of why Node is the way it is, why there's an asynchronous model, how NPM works, how you build applications using Node is as important as just how fast you can develop with Node.
Yeah. I was not on the Node side, but on the client side. We're doing some JavaScript with my buddy at work, Damien Edwards, and we wanted to do some interesting stuff with time. As soon as we mentioned time on Twitter, everyone just goes, oh, moment.js. Mm-hmm. And Damien, who is a pretty senior individual and a smart individual, said, hey, guys, just hang on a second. I want to parse one date, one time, and do one thing with it. And you've all suggested a 100K library that I need to bring in. Like, let's just settle down for a second.
That happens internally as well. I look at a lot of pull requests like, whoa, you're pulling in what to do what?
Right. And he ended up just parsing the string with, index of.
Right.
And I felt kind of gross, but, sometimes senior engineers need to feel kind of gross.
Yes. More often than not, unfortunately.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, those kinds of tough decisions, I think, are hard to make, though, when you're still introducing yourself into a community. It seems like to know which module to use is word of mouth. My friend said it was a good module, so I'll use it.
It totally is. It's a combination of word of mouth, word of Twitter, I guess, some Googling. But I also know that as you come into a community, you tend to bring your old habits and patterns with you. So if you look at some of the earliest Node libraries, there's sort of the pattern of whatever community that developer came from, they're trying to recreate that in Node. So if you came from Ruby, you're trying to recreate Rails in Node. Or if you're coming from Python, you're trying to recreate Django in Node. And it's a good thing to happen because that's how people learn. You apply what you know to this new thing, and then you start discovering exactly what was wrong with your thinking or why this thing is different.
Yep.
I've seen in other communities like Go. Go is very prescriptive and structured about, how you write code, how you use the standard library. They're kind of anti-framework because a lot of the standard library provides what you need. And you can see the evolution of the libraries and frameworks in that community change from, okay, we got all the people from the dynamic languages communities coming in, building these things. Then they took a step back. And I think the most famous example there was the author of the Martini framework, which is a Sinatra-like clone in Go. And after enough people said, hey, this is an idiomatic Go, he stepped back and said, you're right. And then having that experience of writing some Go at that point, he wrote a new framework called Negroni that actually matched the expectations and patterns of that community. And we see similar things in Node, that people evolve, learn what the best patterns are, and then evolve how they build their libraries and applications.
Do you think that a lot of enterprises that are starting out with JavaScript and Node, they're trying to write it like it's Java, or they're trying to write it like it's COBOL? Yes.
Well, we haven't seen COBOL, but definitely Java-like approaches. We haven't worked with too many Microsoft shops to see, but I would expect, you know, if they were .NET, I'd see a similar pattern of them trying to write it like C#.
I'm envisioning a lot of what we call arrow code, you know, if, and then unrolling all the way. Not a lot of functional programming paradigms.
There's quite a bit of that, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
And again, it's an education process. So we will, you know, send people for like a week, work with their developers, mm-hmm. understand what their applications are, and then teach them, you know, this is the callback pattern in JavaScript. You know, this is how the event loop works. Here's how timers work. And then help them sort of translate their mental model of how their system currently works to a way that'll work best with Node and take advantage of its capabilities.
What do you think is it about Node that is causing people to, you know, kind of jump in and make these kind of rather naive mistakes that you don't necessarily see in C? Is it because it is a dynamic language? Is it because it's just a text editor and a command line that it makes it seem like it's a Wild West?
I think it's a combination of the fact that it is a dynamic language. It's accessible. People are coming from the browser world. You know, so people understand the web browser and being able to write JavaScript to do things in it. And there's probably a lot of misconceptions. The biggest one I've always heard is you're using Node so you can write JavaScript on the server and the client. And if you're a browser developer, you can write server stuff. I've written enough server stuff in my time to tell you that just because you know how to write JavaScript in the browser, it's not the same thing on the server. So that's a bit of a fallacy that's been propagated over the years.
That's a big statement. We should pause on that for a second, because that may have been one of the reasons that people jumped into Node. Like, people may be listening and they may be like, wait, what?
Oh, it absolutely was. I mean, I've heard it so often. It's just become this thing where, I've done web development for years. I know JavaScript. I can go right on the server.
Right. When usually what they mean is they know the DOM.
They know the DOM and they know the syntax of the language.
Right.
They don't necessarily understand the behavior of the system on the server is obviously way different than it is in the browser. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of the hook that gets them in. I mean, a crude way of saying it's sort of like the drug dealer model. You know, the first hit's free. You know, a little JavaScript gets you in, then you get a little Node, and then you get really wrapped into it. But, you know, as you progress, you'll realize that there are certain concerns that you have on the server that are fundamentally different than they are in the browser. Mm-hmm. And even in the core level of Node, as where IOJS started picking up steam, we're seeing a lot of the pull requests coming in, the features that people want to add are very influenced by browser-based development and don't necessarily work or could create problems for server-side development. So there is, you know, that sort of impedance mismatch that has to get resolved. And I know we have one of the Node core developers on our team. You know, he's frequently, you know, trying to push back on some of these things, saying, well, understand why you want to do this, you know, for browser development. Here's why it's going to be a problem on the server. And let's not rush to just go and change this, because you will break applications that are in production right now. Mm-hmm. And we can't have that. So it's definitely a real concern.
So as we close up here, I want to ask you kind of a trick question.
Okay.
I want to ask you about microservices, because that seems to be the hot new word right now.
Yes.
And as we are probably contemporaries, we may have a shared opinion on this. I saw a really great tweet where someone said, you know, my in-process call doesn't have enough latency, so I'm going to, you know, use microservices.
That's a good one.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Do you think that we're breaking things apart that don't need to be broken apart?
I definitely think that that's probably the norm right now as far as microservices go. Microservices do solve a particular problem, but you have to know you have that problem. I think there's a lot of people who are just either saying, hey, microservices, it's the new SOA. SOA is at a much coarser
service-oriented
architecture. Mm-hmm. And microservices is a it's a facet of SOA. It's not a replacement for SOA. And in fact, we were talking about this today at lunch. You know, we need to educate customers and developers more about that. Like, understand the problem we're trying to solve. And in some cases, it may be microservices. A lot of cases, you're really looking for SOA, and that's not microservices.
And the problem that you might have in a few years may be that you have microservices.
Well, that might be a good problem to have.
Yeah, I suppose.
But I think the bigger problem is that people are always looking for the new shiny, and microservices is the current new shiny. Between microservices and Docker, you know, people are gravitating towards it.
Right.
And all we're saying is understand your problem.
Right.
You know, maybe that's the solution. We're not saying it's not. We're just saying, let's make sure you truly have done the work of understanding your problem before you get into it. Because once you've built it, you own it, and you're going to have to pay the cost of maintaining it over time. If you're not prepared for that, if you're not thinking about that, then you're just going to, you know, basically start yet another dev cycle and create a new problem for yourself. So let's slow it down where it makes sense. Do focus a little bit more on the design and architecture of your solution. And then if microservices is the way to go, great. Let's, you know, build some microservices. A lot of cases, it's just chasing after the new shiny.
Yeah. As my dad liked to say, measure twice, cut once.
Yes.
And then, of course, maybe folks will do that with software from NodeSource.
That is the hope. And I'm happy to help them do it.
Thank you so much, Kevin Stewart from NodeSource, for chatting with me today.
Thank you, Scott. It's been a pleasure being with you.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.